Yes, it's 4 Emmy nominations for Normal People, and The Muppets are back with a new series on Disney Plus. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Normal People, the TV series that engaged everyone in Ireland and Britain as a wonderful, passion-filled counterpoint to COVID, has just been nominated for 4 Emmy Awards. Paul Mescal, who played Connell, has been nominated for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Limited Series. Lenny Abrahamson for Outstanding Directing for a Limited Series. Sally Rooney and Alice Birch for Outstanding Writing for a Limited Series. And Louise Keeley for Outstanding Casting for a Limited Series. I'm delighted to be joined on the phone by director Lenny Abrahamson and producer Ed Gainey. To you first, Lenny, absolute and total delight and congratulations to you. I know we spoke before this series went out, Lenny, and I was a huge fan of then. I'm an even bigger fan now. You must be over the moon.
Yeah, we're really delighted. You know, it's been an amazing afternoon. You know, it's been, I suppose, a few weeks since all of the craziness of the release, and things have kind of died down a bit, and it's lovely to have another blast of positivity from it, and I'm just so happy for everybody involved. And I should say as well that, I mean, it's a cliche, but it is true that the awards are, you know, really, they apply to everybody who worked on the show. We just had so many people of immense talent, cast and crew and production all across the board, and none of it would have been possible without an awful lot of work from those people.
So the Emmys are on the basis of the American release, is that it? That happened a few weeks back, was it?
Yes, I think the American release happened about, I think it was about a week or two after it was released on BBC, so actually pretty much around the same time as the Irish release.
And for you, Ed, when you hear Emmy Award nominations, that's huge in terms of production and what it does for you as a company and indeed for this series.
Yeah, look, it's brilliant, Sean. And it's kind of, you never sort of set out with any expectation around this stuff. It's, you know, when you see the other kind of shows that are nominated, and they're, you know, the very best dramas in the world, and kind of they're all household brands in a sense, you know, kind of... So it's really, I think, makes us all really proud to sort of be up there amongst them, you know, ostensibly quite a small show out of Ireland with, you know, at the time we made it, with, you know, two amazing actors who no one had heard of at that stage, and have now both established themselves as, you know, kind of stars really in their own right. And also, you know, shout out to Daisy, you know, it's sort of such a two-hander, and I think just the way these things kind of fall, you know, the kind of the way these nominations fall, sometimes, you know, they don't include everyone the way that they might, but you know, I think everyone would recognize that the pair of them just did an incredible job together.
I would guess from hearing Paul Mescal speaking at various times that the very first thing he would say that his performance depends on Daisy's performance. So, you know, he knows that it wouldn't exist without her opposite him, and that the two of them really do work as a pair. It is stiff competition, Lenny, isn't it? I mean, have you seen Little Fires Everywhere, Reese Witherspoon and Kerry Washington? That's in there, obviously, for Lynn Shelton, and Unorthodox. I don't know if you saw that series.
Yeah, it's all great stuff, you know, it is. Here's another cliche for you, just to add to the, you know, to add to the basket. It is. I'm delighted to be nominated. Anything else would be a complete bonus. I mean, they're all amazing shows, and they're brilliant directors, and I'm just very happy, you know, to be part of it. But I want to echo what Ed said as well, just and what you said, Sean. That Daisy is. It's an absolute two-hander of a show, and so, you know, she's there in all the nominations.
You're nominated for a specific episode. Is that just how the Emmys work?
Yes, exactly. You put forward an episode that you think represents the best of the work, and that's the one that they will circulate. But I think probably, depends on how much time people have, but the hope is that they'd watch the show as a whole and make their call on that basis.
Yeah, because you nominated episode 5, which is quite a distance in. Obviously, you had 12 parters, so you're halfway in at that stage, and there's a lots of different balls up in the air at that point. What was it about that episode that made you think
this is the one I want to put forward?
I don't. It's hard to say, really. It has a sort of, it goes through there's a lot of range in it, tonally and emotionally, and it's the episode where they get back together again, having met again in college. And there's a scene I just particularly like in the middle of it, where Connell apologizes finally for how he behaved in Sligo, and it's a scene that feels like it's as good as it could have been, and that's probably the main reason.
Well, actually, you know, I have that very clip in front of me right now. Let's have a listen to it. For those who know the show, yeah, they'll know that Connell didn't invite Marianne to the Debs, and that has been a major bone of contention for quite a time, and has had a huge effect on their friendship. For those who don't know the show, I'll whistle and don't listen to what he's about to say to her and to this interaction between the two of them.
Did you ever think about asking me to the Debs? I know it's such a stupid thing, but I'm curious whether you thought about it.
To be honest, no. Yeah, I wish that I did. Yeah. Would you said yes?
Sake.
I'm really sorry. Apparently everybody knew about us anyway.
Everyone knew what?
That we were seeing each other.
I didn't tell anyone, Connell, I swear to God.
Fuck, I know, that's not what I mean. I mean, my point is that even if you had told people, it wouldn't have mattered.
Were they horrible about it?
No. Believe it or not, no one even cared.
And there you go. Emmy nominated Paul Mescal there and Dizzy Edgar Jones in that scene from Normal People. You know, if I shouted at the television when he didn't ask her to the Debs, Lenny Abrahamson, I shouted even louder when he gave that apology. I wanted to beat him around the ears.
Yeah, it did evoke a lot of strong emotions in people watching the show. Yeah, he came in for some criticism, all right.
Yeah. But that I suppose that was part of the joy of it, and it's there in Sally Rooney's writing, and how brilliant, Ed Gainey, that Sally is also nominated for the writing. Sally and Alice Birch, I think, is nominated in there in the outstanding writing as well, is she? Or is it just Sally that's nominated?
Yeah, they're both nominated, actually, and you know, rightly so. That was a great collaboration. And I mean, you know, again, I mean, you know, Alice is a very established and brilliant writer and you know, the person that everybody wants to work with in these islands and even more so now. But it was Sally's first time writing a screenplay, which is really extraordinary, you know, that she could sort of, you know, she took to it so with such great sort of skill and you know, she, you know, incredible, really. Yeah. And brilliant that was recognised and that part of her writing is recognised, you know, obviously apart from the incredible novel that she wrote, but the fact that she was a key part of the adaptation is brilliant. Also.
Yeah, because it's not always the best idea to have, although you've proven this wrong twice, in fact, Lenny, it's not always the best idea to have the author as the adapter of their own work, because they're so attached to the word on the page that it's difficult for them to let go sometimes. But Sally Rooney didn't seem to have that problem.
No, not at all. She was incredibly open and gracious and generous as a collaborator, and she was totally sort of, you know, she herself would say they're very different media and you've got to adjust, you know, to make something work on screen and you can't just transpose things from the novel. So she had no sort of problem with that, and there was no kind of conflict. And I suppose it is a thing that people talk about, that, you know, you should be wary of working with the writer. But I think if people are as clever as Sally and as Emma Donoghue and as, you know, lovely as people, then it's a brilliant thing to have the writer involved.
Yeah, well,
he knows the project better.
Yes, Emma Donoghue, obviously the adapter of her own novel Room, which was Oscar nomination. Well, if you get an Oscar nomination and an Emmy nomination, there must be something right in the adapting of your own work, mustn't there? It was episode 3. Again, the writing is chosen for specific episodes. Did you choose that again, Lenny, yourself and Ed choose that together, or was Sally involved in that choice?
I think we left that up to Sally and Alice. Am I right, Ed, that we would
had some thoughts on it, but yeah, they would have approved it, I think, yeah.
Have you been speaking to Sally since the nominations have been announced? I think you were speaking to her, Ed, were you?
I was in touch with her by email, so she's been very happy. So I haven't spoken to her, but yeah, just trading messages, so.
What does this mean then for the next project, which of course, how far are you into that now, Lenny, in terms of working on Sally Rooney's next adaptation with her?
Well, so we're deep in it, deep in the script really, and we've been working with a brilliant team of writers, Alice Birch again, and then also wonderful Mark O'Halloran and some other like brilliant writers that we're working with, and we're reasonably well progressed, and you know, it really just in terms of when we shoot and how that's going to work, you know, coronavirus has had a big word to say about that as well, so we're kind of debating and discussing that at the moment, but creatively we've been progressing as, you know, as per schedule really during lockdown.
And I suppose it's at the point now that lockdown doesn't affect that too much. You can do a lot of your consultation by email or, you know, by socially distanced meetings if you want to meet face to face.
Yeah, absolutely. We've done, I think, almost all of it, actually all of it, via, you know, video conferencing. And it does make you think about many of the trips that you normally make and whether they're really necessary or not.
Yeah, there you go. You directed the first half of the series, when going back to Normal People. How exactly will it work with Conversation with Friends? Will you take it all on board? Was it purely a time factor that made you do the half of it the last time round, Lenny?
It was a sort of combination. I think it would have been very difficult at the practical end of things. It would have been very difficult to do all of it and still deliver the show on time. But also, you know, having set it up and with Ed and the gang and, you know, done all that work and delivered the first six, it felt like an opportunity to bring another voice in, especially because the novel itself does have a kind of shift in tone halfway through. And I think everybody felt excited about the idea of bringing somebody in and letting them, you know, impose themselves on that end of the story. And so we were very lucky to work with a very brilliant director called Hetty MacDonald, who did the last six episodes. And I think that shift in tone enriches the experience of the show overall.
Have you been speaking to Paul Mescal, either of you, or has that been email contact as well? He must be delighted, because this is essentially his screen debut.
Yeah, I did. I had a quick call with him about half an hour ago, and he was beside himself with delight. So it was lovely to talk to him. He's just really thrilled, and he's been talking to his folks, and they're excited, and it's all, you know, just this wonderful thing.
Obviously, any bit of news like this is hugely important and must be a real morale booster, Ed. But where are things at? You're on the production side of things. Obviously, we've had a very difficult, a very difficult 6-7 months, really, at this stage. Things closing down, stopping effectively in February and March, things just stopping in mid-production. How difficult has it been, and how do you think we can go about putting things back together again?
I mean, it's been really challenging. You know, so many things have just, you know, ground to a halt in mid-shoot. And, you know, there's a lot of people gearing up to reshoot again. One of the, without getting too technical and boring about it, but one of the really big issues for us in terms of, say, shooting something like Conversations with Friends is insurance, because you know, no longer does film insurance cover coronavirus. You know, they've now excluded it. But there was actually very important news today from the British government that they have created a fund of £500 million to support kind of the insurance of production in the UK. And as it turns out, Conversations with Friends will shoot in Belfast. So we'd be covered with that, which actually means that we can probably contemplate making that now later this year or soon after. But it's a big issue for like Irish film, Irish television. We don't have anything lined up to shoot in Ireland in the immediate future, but it's a big issue for other Irish productions. And, you know, because, you know, a small production company can't afford to take that risk. You know, they just, it's impossible.
And was it just, did the insurance companies just say, no, we're not prepared to cover this? Or were there...
Yeah.
nothing can be done about that, or should something be done about that?
Well, what they have to do, what they're bound to do, is cover those productions that, that were already up and running. So, for instance, if you were shooting something and it shut down in the middle, like there's a Ridley Scott film shooting that was shooting in Ireland, and it shut down, and it's now, I think, coming back very soon. Because prior insurance existed on that, then they have to continue with it once it goes back into production. But if it's a new production looking for insurance, the insurers can say, we won't include coronavirus in our cover. That's, you know, they can exclude or include anything they want, if you like. So that is, you know, it's really a big problem. I think that recently the Minister for Arts, new Minister for Arts and Culture, you know, part of what she offered up to the audiovisual, and additional funding for the audiovisual sector, I think, includes something which might help with that. I suspect it's nowhere near enough, but it's something that might help in Ireland. But the British government have weighed in a very meaningful way, which I think, and it's something, you know, it's really important for us to get it right in Ireland, because it just means that new production can't really start until we deal with that issue.
Well, maybe Minister Martin might address that specific point, and we'd be more than happy to hear from her if she can enlighten us as to what could be done for the Irish film and television industry in that particular respect. Finally, Lenny, September the 20th, I think, is the announcement. Will that be a virtual event? Will that be a virtual event, or do you know?
I think it's looking like it will be, unless they go for kind of, you know, hazmat tuxedos or something like that. I can't imagine. Maybe there's a market for that. No, I think, but by all accounts, it's looking like it will be a television show where everybody is on via Zoom or something like that. So God knows how that will actually look. But that's what I think is going to happen.
Well, listen, once again, congratulations to both of you, to you, Ed, for your involvement as producer in Normal People, to yourself, Lenny, for that nomination as director. And let's mention again, Paul Mescal, nominated for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Limited Series in the Emmys, and Louise Kiley, nominated for casting. If you cast well, that's a lot of the work done, and obviously she did it right for you in that particular respect. So congratulations to her as well. I'm sure you'll both want to pass on regards to and best wishes to Outstanding Supporting Actress nomination in the drama series for Fiona Shaw. That's for Killing Eve. And
wonderful.
Guest actor in a drama series for Andrew Scott for Black Mirror. So lots for us to watch out for on the 20th. Congratulations again. Enjoy whatever type of a party you can have at the distance you are from each other. And congratulations to all on that. Lenny Abrahamson and Ed Gainey. Now, do you feel all warm and glowy inside? Well, the fun, the fur and the felt return this week as the Muppets come to Disney's streaming service this Friday, in fact, with an all-new show called Muppets Now. And here to discuss is RTE reporter and, I'm told, one of Ireland's, if not Ireland's actual biggest Muppet fan, Liam Geraghty. I saw a lovely picture of you as a young fella surrounded by Muppets paraphernalia. How far back does your relationship with the Muppets go? And it comes kind of via your parents, I think, as well, Liam.
It does, Sean. Yeah, God, I've been into the Muppets. I was essentially raised by the Muppets. So I was a baby in the 80s. And so
Which of them was your mammy and which of them was your daddy?
There's Barbara and Bill.
I was asking which Muppet was your mammy and which Muppet was your daddy.
I was always a Gonzo. I was always into Gonzo being the weirdo.
Yeah. So that's your dad. He loved that. And your mum? Be careful.
Mum, I couldn't. You don't have much choice with that. Thanks. We'll come back to that, Sean.
Yeah.
I suppose, you know, I watched... I had just missed them, really, I suppose. But I was born in 83, and so they were kind of around in the 80s and finished up in 82.
Yeah.
But when I was growing up, I we got the VHS copies of them. I was trying to track down every episode I could get. I used to run up to the neighbors who had Video Plus. They had a VCR with Video Plus, and I used to make them record it for me. It was on very early in the morning. And I was just... like I was obsessed. I'm still obsessed to this day. And my parents used to say that I learned everything I know about the world from the Muppets, because I'd be talking about these stars like Danny Kaye or Ethel Merman or Roy Rogers, you know, and I was only a young lad in the 80s, and they were just, you know, from a different era, but I knew all about them because they used to guest star on the Muppets. So I watched it absolutely religiously.
Yeah, and that guest star aspect of the show was hugely important at various points along the way. For you, how would you describe, with the benefit of your age and wisdom now, Liam, how would you describe what the Muppets were doing back in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s?
I mean, it was incredible, really, to think about it, because the Muppet Show at one stage was the number one show in the world. Like it was had the top ratings, you know, so the entire world was watching it. But it was kind of, I mean, it was different because it was kind of, you know, it was a variety show and it was for the whole family. Even though I suppose puppets tend to have this connotation of being for kids, but this was something that was slightly different. It was slightly kind of anarchic, and you know, the humor of it was very particular, so it could really be enjoyed by everyone, and it was absolutely, like, I mean, Jim Henson was a figure like Walt Disney. He was doing something that literally just hadn't been done before.
Let's listen to Jim Henson actually appearing. This is before The Muppet Show had actually hit, because he'd been involved obviously in Sesame Street, and the Furry Felty Muppets or puppets had been there at that time, you know, and some of the characters who went on to be part of the show obviously were there as well. But here he is on the what's his name, Carson show.
Johnny Carson.
Johnny Carson, the Johnny Carson show with Dr. Teeth. And he appears with Dr. Teeth sitting along. And it's Jim Henson himself shifting from his own voice to Dr. Teeth's voice.
We are back. My next guest is a most imaginative and talented gentleman who created the famous puppets who will be featured in a TV special at 8 o'clock tomorrow night called The Muppet Show. Would you welcome, please, Jim Henson.
Hello, Jim. Excuse my left hand.
Hello.
He's
got to
go on the best dress list, you know that.
Oh, yeah, you like my threads. Oh, yeah.
My threads. That's Dr. Teeth, huh? How are you, Doctor?
I'm good. Oh, yeah.
Good to see you.
Nice to be here. You feel made so... the big time, didn't I? Yeah.
Boy. In the big room.
Oh, yeah.
How would you describe your music? What is that? Is that rock or jazz?
Well, it's like catastrophe music. It's a towering inferno with bongo drums.
You know? Yeah. Do you get a lot of chicks now? That, you know, most rock stars have the groupies now that you're a big star. Know,
being a puppet, it's sort of different. You know? The head of my fan club is Nangora Sweater. You know? Comes out of Dubuque, Iowa, you know. She's really fuzzy, though, man. Yeah. All right. Dig that fuzz.
Yeah.
So there you go, Jim Henson on the Johnny Carson show. And as you can hear, that was actually March the 18th, 1975, with the special coming up later that week. So obviously the Muppet Show itself hadn't really been invented at that point. It was kind of in the offing, I guess. They were testing the water. But you get a sense of that, Liam Geraghty, that it actually could have adult humour buried in amongst the fun that, you know, most of that would go right over children's head, I guess.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. And I think Jim Henson was, you know, after doing Sesame Street, he wanted to make something that wasn't, you know, just for kids again. He wanted to kind of bridge that gap. And even the pilot show of The Muppet Show, not a lot of people know this, but the pilot episode was actually called Muppets, Sex and Violence. And I suppose with the gag being that there was none in it, but it was a good title.
Yeah, and actually, there's an interesting scene later on in that Johnny Carson show where Kermit is being interviewed by Johnny Carson, and Carson asks him, "How's your sex life?" And he shuts him right down, saying, "Oh no, I'm on Sesame Street. Don't ask me a question like that." And he just stops him dead.
Well, I think it's probably Kermit is one of the characters who did kind of was on both shows, so I think that's probably fair enough. But they did tend to be, you know, kind of, you know, they don't shy away, and certainly Henson was very vocal in the fact of bringing these puppets onto shows and having them on his arm. Whereas if you see like Kermit or Miss Piggy on any of the talk shows now, on Jimmy Kimmel or Conan O'Brien, they're always embedded into the couch, you know, like as their own character.
Yeah.
But at the time, he was very, you know, saying that, you know, it's fine, that we know it's a puppet, it's fine, and people will accept it. And they did. You know, so
yeah, and there was no attempt at you know, that he wasn't trying to cover the fact that he was actually doing the voice. You could see his lips moving. There was no ventriloquist trick involved.
Now, yes, exactly. Yeah.
So that was then. This is now, and it's Muppets now. What is happening on Disney Plus? And when a big corporation like Disney Plus takes over the Muppets, what happens?
Yeah, well, I suppose Disney have had, just before Jim Henson died, he was in negotiations with Disney. And so they've kind of been looking after the Muppets for a good 30 years now. But yeah, this week is going to be the launch of their new show, which is called Muppets Now. And we haven't really seen the Muppets for about 5 years since quite an ill-fated series that was simply called The Muppets, that was kind of a mashup of 30 Rock meets The Office. And it was co-created by Bill Brady, who created The Big Bang Theory. And it kind of what we were talking about there, it kind of leaned a little bit too far into the adult stuff, and we were kind of having, you know, Muppets with midlife crises and, you know, all sorts of things, and it just didn't wash. It was cancelled after the first season, and then of course just after that happened, Disney fired Steve Whitmer, who had been performing Kermit the Frog for over 30 years. He took over from Jim Henson, so there was kind of a lot of, you know, public spats and ill will over that. So we haven't really seen the Muppets do anything for the last 5 years or so. So Muppets Now is a new show that's going to be on their streaming service on Friday. We originally thought, us Muppets fans, diehard Muppets fans who've been following this, thought that it was originally going to be something different. Josh Gad, who, you know, is the voice of Olaf in Frozen, he was actually developing a reboot that sounded amazing. It was going to take up, it was going to be a series that took up the story after the Muppets Take Manhattan film, and it was going to be called The Muppets Live Another Day, and it was a really great project, but again, creative differences didn't happen. So in the meantime then, they kind of thought that they would start putting together these kind of short Muppet videos, kind of like YouTube channel kind of types of videos, very short, and they were just going to put them up as separate videos, but they've decided to kind of lump them all together, collect them up, and basically package them into kind of 20-minute, like 20-minute sketch shows.
And given that, you know, the old style, I suppose, was it was the music hall, and it had that variety program, that variety hall aspect to it, and we saw a little bit backstage as well. That was the whole conceit of the thing in the original Muppets. This time we're in more of a, almost, I suppose we're in a television, a chat show type of environment. That's the idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose we've been here before twice, you know, with the kind of the adaptation to the Muppets being kind of in a TV studio. This time round, it's almost like they're one step further. It's like they have little YouTube channel videos.
Yeah.
And in between, they talk to each other kind of on, you know, video conferencing, which was all filmed actually during the lockdown, which was kind of interesting. So all the puppets had been sent to all the performers, and I'd actually had cause to interview Dave Golds, who performs Gonzo the Great, and he told me that when the Muppets arrived in a big wooden crate, he left them in his garage for a couple of weeks, and then he disinfected them. He wouldn't go near them until he thought they were clean.
What about who's performing Miss Piggy, by the way, in this series?
So that's a performer called Eric Jacobson, and we also have Matt Vogel, who's taking over as Kermit. This is the first time we're going to see really Matt Vogel's Kermit in any kind of big way, because really, I mean, we just had Jim Henson, and then we had Steve Whitmer for 30 years, and it's, I mean, I've watched the first two episodes, and I'm not entirely convinced by Kermit's voice just yet.
I have Miss Piggy here. Let's have a listen to Miss Piggy in her own programme, which she thought was going to be called Lifestyle, but she finds out to the difference.
Hey guys! I started this little vlog as a way to give back to the people who love me the most. Everyone! And it all starts now! Are you kidding me with this title? This is not what we talked about! Lifestyle!
Texting the graphics team in Lithuania.
Today's topic is personal style.
Ooh, in that case, shall I pick a different outfit for you?
Clothes that compliment you, or at least a wardrobe person who does.
Ooh, Piggy, you are working this top to death.
What was that?
Nothing.
Accentuate your favorite features. What's your favorite feature, Deadly?
I'd have to say that I've always been partial to my beard.
I mean, favorite feature of mine!
Of course. It would be your...
Careful!
Everything?
Correct! Thank you! Your flaws! They're what make you one of a kind! Deadly, what's my biggest flaw?
I don't want to play this game.
Oh, come on! It'll be fun!
No, I shan't.
Come on! I'm gonna own it! What's my biggest flaw?
All right. Well, are we talking external flaw or internal flaw?
Get out of my sight.
All right, there it is.
There we go. A clip from Miss Piggy's Lifestyle programme, which is part of the new Muppets Now series that Liam Geraghty is speaking to us about right now. I watched the first two episodes too. I didn't laugh a lot. I didn't find myself tickled by much of it, Liam.
Yeah, it's kind of... I suppose if I was to give it marks, I'd give it maybe 3 out of 5 at a push. I mean, and really, like I'm a lifelong Muppet fan and I watch everything they do. And I mean, I can tell you that it's not always a rewarding experience. You know, you kind of, I think the Muppets, the characters kind of have a lot of goodwill, and that kind of gets them by these days, I think, because the writing is so crucial to them. They're so character driven. But here, yeah, you're absolutely right. There's something kind of lacking, and I think it's maybe because all of these shorts were originally intended just to be standalone by themselves, and they've kind of been lumped together. And I suppose this has also been marketed as unscripted.
Yeah.
And it's kind of unscripted in the way Curb Your Enthusiasm is unscripted. Yeah. And that clearly there's an outline, but you do see that come through sometimes, but not in a good way, in a kind of a performer struggling to be funny. And I mean, a lot of the performers, you know, they're doing a great job. But I mean, when you look back at Jim Henson and Frank Oz and Jerry Nelson and all these people, they were just naturally funny. You know, they could go on a talk show and be funny, whereas, you know, it's kind of an imitation of something that happened before.
That's what it seems like. While that's a very good version of Miss Piggy's voice, there's no doubt about that. There's just something missing in the humour, it struck me. And of course, you know, you can make scripted material sound unscripted. That's the great skill that the Muppets had in the original series. You know, that's called acting, I think, is the old word for that. So nevertheless, will you persevere, having seen the first two episodes? I think it's a 6-part series, this new Muppets Now. Will you persevere, Liam, when it comes out on Friday night on Disney Plus?
I definitely will. I mean, you have celebrity guests. RuPaul is in the first one. Yeah. So, there's hopefully, I kind of have my fingers crossed for this. But like I said, I push through and watch everything that they're in. But it's not always great. But here's hoping.
So which pup Muppet was your mother? Thought I forgot, didn't you?
God, the only ones I can think of were all pigs, and that's not going to
Wash. Let me ask you then for your favourite clip, because that's how we'll finish up, give you a little bit of nostalgia. You can apologise to your father for calling him Gonzo earlier on. What's your favourite clip?
So one of my favourite clips from the original Muppet Show was this one where Rolf the dog, Jim Henson, and Fozzie Bear, Frank Oz, kind of do a little duet. So Rolf is on the piano here.
Yeah. And Ozzy, well, or Fuzzy rather, just listen.
I got rhythm. I got rhythm.
Wait, wait,
Ozzy, hold on. Now you're starting wrong. It goes like this. Let me show you. I got rhythm.
Oh, gotcha, gotcha.
Okay.
I got
gotcha, it, gotcha. Now.
I got rhythm. I got.
Fozzie, hold one second. Let me make one little change here. Okay, I'll sing it.
Yes, sir. I don't got rhythm. I don't got rhythm.
That's for sure.
I don't got rhythm.
Who could ask for anything more?
We could.
Yeah, earplugs. Who could ask for anything?
Absolutely wonderful. Frank Oz and Jim Henson there in a scene from the original Muppets. Liam Gertie was speaking to us about the latest offering, which is Muppets Now, and it premieres this Friday, July the 31st on Disney Plus. The Northern Soul movement began with working class kids from the north of England in the 1970s. With its unique fashions and dance styles, it spoke of freedom and escape. People would travel hundreds of miles to gather together en masse and dance until the break of dawn. The music of Northern Soul was predominantly black American soul records from the 60s and 70s, and the more obscure that music was, the better. Today, the music and dance of Northern Soul still lives on and attracts music loves that are both as fanatical about the rarity of these records as they are about the complexity of the dance moves. Kellyanne Byrne is with me in studio this evening to give us a where do I start with Northern Soul. I was full sure you'd be in your very wide pants. Don't you need wide pants to dance?
You do. Yeah. The look was kind of wide Oxford baggy trousers, vest tops, you know, leather sole shoes. But obviously it was all about the music. The music was the main thing. Mm. And as you mentioned there, it was an obsession with obscure black American soul music from the mid 60s. By kids from Northern England. So the music itself didn't originate in Northern England, but the obsession with it did.
And what do you think was it about, you know, these, I was watching a documentary about it last night, you know, white working class kids in the north of England who suddenly latched on to this black music from the industrial heartlands, essentially, of America. And some of it just almost like local radio type of stuff or local record labels, certainly not big international names.
Absolutely not. The emphasis was on obscure records. And it's interesting you say that because a lot of these kids from Northern England, they were from, you know, areas of high unemployment. The factory line was kind of their fate and they became obsessed with this type of music from the States, from similar type of areas over there. And really, these records gave them something to live for, you know. They became very passionate about it. It really was a way of life, an obsession. Mm. And it originated with mob culture in the 60s in the Flamingo in London, where they played a lot of Stax and kind of Motown records. That's where the all-nighter began.
All-nighter being that you literally went to what would have been kind of ballroom dancing halls, but you danced all night
to
soul music.
Exactly, till 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. That sound went up north. But the difference was, like we said, kids from up north became obsessed with a specific, obscure type of record that had a fast, up-tempo beat, 4x4 beat that they could dance to.
I want to play a record. When I listened to this earlier today, I thought, but we all know that really well, but we know it really well because it was plucked from obscurity. When it was first released in 1964, it disappeared without trace.
Exactly.
This song, just listen.
Keep it.
There we go. Gloria Jones with Tainted Love from 1964. Kellyanne Byrne is with me in studio this evening to help me to begin or start with Northern Soul as an art form. I mean, that most people will know the Soft Cell version from 1981, but that version in 1981 in itself was a kind of an homage to the Northern Soul movement.
Absolutely, and I think it kind of sparked interest in the Northern Soul scene once again. But it's like you said there, the original from 1964 made no impact. And that was the fascinating thing about a lot of these records that became huge on the Northern Soul scene. When they were first released, nobody had any real interest in them. A lot of them were discarded. They were considered that the quality wasn't as good as a lot of Motown records. But then they were played on the Northern Soul scene and became huge tracks. But I think it's really important to talk about the DJs that went abroad to the States, to places like Detroit and Chicago and New York, and picked up these records.
Yeah, so who were those people? Who were the big leading lights in that respect?
Well, one DJ was Ian Levine, and he played at the Highland Ballroom at the Mecca in Blackpool. And this is a really great story because he went over with his parents to Miami when he was quite young, really into Northern Soul. It was just beginning. And instead of hanging out at the pool all day, he went to charity shops and record shops for hours and hours, so that by the end of the week, he'd collected 4,000 records. And the story goes, the family were due to go to the Bahamas, and the plane couldn't take off due to the weight. And the dad was saying, I'm going to throw these out the window. Yeah. And he begged with his father, please, you know, this is my passion. Please, I have to take them back to England. And he brought these records back to England. And it's considered the greatest haul of Northern Soul records in history. That was Ian Levine from Highland Ballroom in Blackpool.
And the other aspect of that is, you know, it's not as if they were going in and these records were everywhere. In some cases, there might only have been, you know, 100 or a couple of hundred actual pressings in that efficient, not print run, whatever you would call it, the first pressing of the record. And that would be it. It'd be disappeared. Then the masters would be disappeared.
Absolutely. And a lot of kind of demos were released, like you say, very, you know, not many copies, very unknown artists. There's a really interesting story behind Do I Love You, Indeed I Do, Frank Wilson, which is kind of a very famous Northern Soul record, but originally 250 copies were pressed. And the story goes that Berry Gordy from Motown, apparently he didn't like the sound of Frank Wilson's voice, but also Frank Wilson had expressed an interest in producing, and Berry Gordy didn't like this because he never wanted his singers to get too big for their boots, and he ordered the 250 copies to be destroyed. So two that we know of were saved, they think possibly five, and one went for 25 grand in 2009, the most expensive record ever to be auctioned.
Right.
Frank Wilson, Do I Love You, Indeed I Do.
Frankie Valli not a big name, or did, in fact, Northern Soul create the big name for him in Britain?
I think with this track, The Night, that we're probably about to play, again, that was a record that didn't really make a big impact when it was first released, I think in early 70s. Frankie Valli blamed it on poor promotion, but that was another one that they played on the Northern Soul scene and it became massive. I think this is probably my favourite Northern Soul tune.
There you go, Frankie Valli and The Night, one of the big tracks of Northern Soul. Kellyanne Byrne with me in studio this evening to answer the question, where do I begin with Northern Soul? I suppose the dancing, you know, the music, obviously you can just listen to the music and enjoy it, but the dancing was vital to the survival and to that initial life of Northern Soul, Kellyanne.
Absolutely. The music was number one, but dancing was so important. And if you watch, you said you watched a documentary last night, so it was a lot of kind of backflips, splits, kicks. They say influenced by Jackie Wilson, Bruce Lee.
Yeah, Bruce Lee was a big that the guys watched Bruce Lee, and that was the kind of moves that they were trying to bring onto the dance floor to impress the women that they were trying to attract.
Yeah, and there was a lot of competitiveness among dancers as well. But you know what? When you look at it now, the dance moves, I feel it's really the beginning of break dancing.
Yeah.
If you think about it, that was kind of the start of it. So, very athletic. The clothes were kind of designed then to, you know, to be able to move in. And they would dance at Wigan Casino from like 2 p.m. until 8 a.m.
I know, it's an extraordinary thing to think that the dancers, it was like the all-night rave before the all-night rave ever existed. But
the
style of the dancing, you mentioned breakdancing there, that struck me looking at some of it.
Yeah.
A lot of those, whereas in breakdancing it might be done on the head or on, you know, on the bottom, on the ground, spinning around.
Yeah.
They were spinning around standing up. That spinning movement seemed to be vitally important to it.
Yeah, the spinning movement was huge and just really kind of beautiful to watch, you know, and... it's just, if you watch, the other thing was the clapping in unison, which you may have seen in the documentary as well. And at somewhere like Wigan Casino, which on any given night could have over 2,000 people, imagine 2,000 people clapping on the beat to a record. And it's just really, I don't know, I think when you watch people dance, I get goosebumps every time.
Yeah, because there's another aspect of the dancing that struck me. It's not 1,000 miles away from line dancing, but just the music makes it look like something. Did you not think, or was that just me?
I don't know.
Well, that unison clapping, and they had the little shimmies on the on the feet as well. It had a touch of that about it.
There was a shimmy. Very... very light
on
your
feet. Get the line dancing image out of your head now. Okay.
Very light on your feet for sure. But yeah, no, the dancing was a big part of it too, and the fashion, like you say. But definitely number one, the music, and dancing second.
Right. What about Dublin in the midst of all of this? Bubbles, the nightclub, 1980s?
Yes. I was too young to go to it, but Bubbles was a club, like you say, in the 90s. The 80s, sorry, pardon me. In the Temple Bar Hotel. And some kind of big Northern Soul DJs, such as Joe Moran, I think I mentioned that to you, and Paul Davis, talk about their memories of their nights there. And one of the things I find so adorable was that the clubs were on, I think, Wednesday and Sunday from 8 until 11:15, so people could get the last bus. How cute is that?
Well, you know what, I would have thought getting the first bus was what you should have been doing if you were going to an all nighter.
Yeah, I mean, they couldn't be all nighters, unfortunately, at that time. But like, that was really the beginning of it here. And then there's been nights ever since. Like, my first introduction to Northern Soul was in Brussels. Myself and my best friend Michelle used to go in, and I remember Dandelion playing, fantastic DJ, playing a lot of Northern Soul records, Joe Moore and Paul Mulholland. And I was really into Paul Weller and the Jam, but I'd never heard of the word Northern Soul. And so as a 17-year-old, you know, it was really fascinating to me to hear these records. They were so euphoric and just, I can't describe the feeling when you hear them when you're out and about. And there's just a joy to the records, I think. It's like, I don't think my love of that music will ever die.
Yeah. Well, it kind of has a kind of timeless quality to it, which is part of the harking back nature. Even in the 1970s, there was a sense of it harking back to an earlier time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We'll finish up with possibly one of the greatest of the hits, which is, I guess, this is probably the track that you should start with if you were trying to get into Northern Soul in the first place. But if you had to give me a few names that you go searching for, because you don't have to go to record shops now and fish out the obscure records, you'll find it all on YouTube probably. You'll find it all online.
You would find it all online. And I guess a good place to start is a lot of the compilations, if you don't know about it. Wigan Casino, you know, there's been a lot of great compilations brought out over the years. It's all there on the internet once you Google it. Lots of great stuff. So
Wigan Casino, Northern Soul is probably a good starting point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Out on the Floor, Dobie Gray. What makes this so great for you?
I think this record was all about dancing. When you listen to the lyrics, I'm a king out on the floor. And really, so it kind of personifies, you know, the Northern Soul movement and the idea of dancing all night.
Dobie Gray with Out on the Floor, one of the great hits of Northern Soul. And it was Kellyanne Byrne who was helping us to answer the question, where do I begin with Northern Soul on this Tuesday evening? That's our lot for tonight. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy research. John Meegan was the broadcast coordinator. Gar Duffy was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan.